Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
I am so looking forward to this discussion. David Fitzgerald is an award-winning author, historical researcher, international public speaker, and a longtime passionate atheist activist. In a career spanning over 20 years, he's worked for or with the Secular Student Alliance, American Atheists, Center for Inquiry, Camp Quest West, American Humanist Association, and of course, RFR, and several other free thought organizations, conferences, and secular events. So yes, that's not a rather amazing bio. So welcome, David. We're so glad to have you with us today.
I cannot tell you how happy I am to be here. I'm super delighted.
Isn't your first time being here either. You've had another discussion with us before.
That was just in April, I think. And if anybody saw that, I'll be touching on some of the things I talked about that in that talk, this one. So it dovetails nicely. And if you didn't see it, you're not missing anything because I've brought out some more slides to show us.
Fantastic.
So what are you going to be talking to us about today?
It's called The Evolution of God, but in fact, it's about the evolution of religion. This little topic about the evolution of all world religions throughout all human history.
That sounds like a really tiny little topic.
Yes.
I don't know just how you're going to be able to fill an hour with this guy. No.
Right. I was talking to Eric before the show started, and I've been all this week. I've been at the e-conference for the Historical Jesus with the Global Center for Religious Research, and I remember thinking to myself, "Oh wow, I've got the talk for RFR the day after the conference." I'm almost done with the show. I'll just get it ready on Sunday night or Monday. And it's like, 15 minutes before it's time for me to go on. I'm still.
Are you telling me you procrastinated about this?
No, not at all. That's the sad thing. It's like, no, I jumped right on it Sunday. In fact, I left the conference early to get working on this. And it's still, it's just that time just flew by. But I've got 7 pages and I've got lots of slides. And I think it's all in some order. So I think we'll be good.
Let's do this. Take it away, my friend.
Thanks so much to everybody for coming here, first of all. Let me see how this is working. Yes. So the talk tonight is The Evolution of God. It's actually The Evolution of Religion. And it's based in a large part on Robert Wright's book, The Evolution of God, with a healthy dose of Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, along with one of my favorite books, Israel Finkelstein and Neil Silberman's The Bible Unearthed. And helping hand from Karen Armstrong, Barbara King, and David Sloan Wilson, who have all written them some amazing books. We're starting out just with a little fun. I've posted a cartoon here from Paul Kinsella called History of Religion. And the first panel is a caveman bowing to magic rocks. Then he's bowing to magic animals. Then he's bowing to magic invisible animals in the sky. Then invisible people in the sky. And then we see a later medieval ancient person bowing to fewer invisible people in the sky. And the last three are people who claim to have come from the sky and people who claim to speak for the people who claim to have come from the sky. And the last is growing up, where there's somebody not bowing down to anybody, but just seeing the universe as it is. And I couldn't resist putting that in the beginning here. What have we got? So I'm starting out with a picture of what I hope was meant to be a person staring up at the nighttime sky. And wanting to start with that because to look at the evolution of religion, the first thing we have to do is get in the minds of those first ancestors of ours who were looking up at the night sky and the universe around them and trying to make sense of it all. And that brings us to pre-human, pre-religion. I've got a quote here from Xenophanes. He says, "The Ethiopes say their gods are flat-nosed and black, while the Thracians say that theirs have blue eyes and red hair. Yet if cattle or horses or lions had hands and could draw and could sculpt like men, then the horses would draw their gods like horses and cattle like cattle. And each they would shape bodies of gods in the likeness, each kind of their own. Man, I've gone too far and I don't know how to back up. There we go. So let me talk about some of the things that Daniel Dennett has brought up about the way we evolved before we were human and the religious, the evolutionary traits and advantages and options that we were co-opted by religion much later. He points out that we're pattern seeking animals and we have an overactive agency detection. And what he means by that is we tend to see faces in the sky. We tend to think there are people out there even when there's not. And the reason they give for that is that it's safer to be wrong about a tiger that's not really there than to be wrong about not spotting a real tiger that is there. Now, Stuart Guthrie made that connection. Dennett also points out that chimpanzee society shows some very clear parallels with human society. Like us, they have politics, they have alliances, they have competition for sex partners, et cetera, et cetera. But they also have reciprocal altruism. And besides, when you're in small tribal groups, you can't just misbehave without consequences. You can't just hop on a bus and leave town. There's no anonymous crimes. So the very fact that most of us evolved in small groups of mostly relatives tends to have a moralizing effect in society. I'm going a little further now. Actually, I'm going backwards. Let me go a little further. Prehistoric roots of religion. There's lots of things in our prehistoric environment that are ripe for creating religious impulses in humans. There was our relationship with animals, with prey and predators, with snakes and flying birds. All of those, especially snakes and flying birds, found their way into mythology because of the way they impacted our imagination. Nature, fire, ocean, plant life, earthquakes and volcanoes, the moon and the sun, the stars and the change of seasons, extreme weather like storms and lightning or drought, and just the psychological things that played on people's minds, even Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon minds, dreams, nightmares, the unknown, sex, birth, aging, disease, and death. I just want to point out one thing in particular. Fire must have been just an amazing, unlike anything else in the human experience. It could hurt you. It could help you. It could warm your food. It could eat the whole world if you weren't careful. Was it alive? Was it a spirit? You know, was it something different? Dreams at night. It dreams anything could happen. At dreams, your dead relatives could come and you could have conversations with them. And all sorts of different societies have had a different relationship with the way they view dreams and nightmares. Religion is largely devoted to explaining why good things and bad things happen. And prehumans probably began their tendency to find agency in nature by sharpening their social interactions with each other. First, just by thinking, is he going to punch me? Is she going to betray me? And then by being able to talk about it, to ask them directly. This, and I don't mean this in a sexist way at all, but I've always had a feeling that talking came out of the urge to share gossip. And I think it wouldn't surprise me if women invented talking. I'm not trying to be a sexist jerk when I say that, but I think that sharing of information seems to me a very feminine trait, and it would not surprise me at all if women were the first ones to invent talking. If bad things happen, it often means that someone's mad for me, people would think back in the day, and maybe I need to make it right. Now, when we take that from people and substitute some god or spirit or some other force of nature we don't understand, You're following a rule found in every religious impulse. And lastly, before we move on, well, actually, let's move on. Religion before religion. When we were hunter-gatherers about 12,000 years ago, and I've got a picture here of a couple cavemen in a cave working with primitive art to put designs on a cave wall. By that time, biological evolution wasn't our only designer at work. We started to have cultural evolution of memes, of beliefs, of habits, of rituals, songs, technologies, theories, et cetera, et cetera. And we've even discovered that Neanderthals had music and funeral rites, and who knows what other parts of culture they had. And of course, in recent years, we've discovered that weren't just Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals, but there was Floriensis, there was Denisovian, multiple groups of humanoids at the same time, possibly.
David, real quick, can you back up? You had said that humanity shared memes. Now, most of us know that memes are pictures with words on them, but can you be a little more specific? Because I don't think they had the internet back then.
Gotcha. And what I mean by meme is any kind of idea that's transmittable, beliefs, habits, rituals, songs, any sort of technology, any kind of theory. They did have the ability to exchange those things. And when that kind of evolution gets started, it's a Lamarckian evolution. It does build on itself. And there's a strong growth. And in fact, even what we call primitive religion had been culturally evolving for a long, long time.
Got it.
Some other things. Yeah, no worries. Humans, as I said, evolved in small groups. And there's a conformist bias that were built in by evolution because survival often depended on social support, sharing food, fighting together, rather than challenging incorrect beliefs. And religious beliefs consist largely of claims that are tough to falsify in the first place. So there was not a lot of incentive to do so. Let's see what's kind of the spiritual environment humans were living in 12,000 years ago. There was lots of belief in supernatural beings by this time. Elemental forces like spirits of nature and or their controllers. Sometimes there was a controlling god in front of all these animistic series forces. Animal spirits themselves, the spirits of their ancestors. And generally there was a high god, not necessarily a god in charge of any other gods, because by this time there weren't any pantheons, but usually a creator type god. And again, there was no kind of ordered pantheon because in fact, hunter-gatherer religion doesn't actually exist. The kind of beliefs and rituals that we think of as religious are so interwoven with everyday life that they never had a word for them. And even hunter-gatherers today don't. The supernatural world and the natural world are one and the same. The problem of evil isn't a problem for them because none of their gods are all powerful, none of their gods are morally perfect, and they don't worship their gods. In fact, sometimes they berate them. The Ainu in Japan had a very interesting relationship with their gods. They wouldn't spit into a campfire because that would offend the goddess of the hearth, but if the god of winds or god of fill in the blanks did something wrong, they would chew them out and they would threaten to not give them offerings until they turned their behavior around. 19th century scholars were surprised that savages had such well-defined and praiseworthy morals, but it wasn't a moral morality based on any divine laws handed down to them. And though religion is largely about morals today, it doesn't seem to have started out that way. Another interesting fact is all hunter-gatherer religions have an afterlife, but not in the same way we do. There's no karmic scorekeeping. There's no heaven or hell carrot or stick scheme. Often, everybody's spirit goes to the same place. And in the societies where there are subdivisions about where you go after you die, often it would depend not on how you lived, but on how you died. For Andaman Islanders, people who drowned became sea spirits. Otherwise, you were likely to become a jungle spirit. In the Pacific Northwest, the Haida who drowned became killer whales. And then we came to the next stage in religious evolution. Whenever people sense a puzzling but powerful force, they want to believe there's a way to comprehend it. And so naturally, the next step in hunter-gatherer religion was a demand for religious experts who claimed they could fathom its mysteries, like prehistoric stock analysis.
David, before you move on, how do we know that what these people believed 12,000 years ago before we had written language? And I would assume the verbal stories have really changed over how can we determine
excellent
that?
Question. And you're right, we only know it by analogy with hunter-gatherer societies that have survived to today and have been able to be studied by anthropologists.
So you're comparing hunter-gatherer societies today and extrapolating that into
that has survived all this time. And it's a good point you're bringing up, because that's not a perfect cognate. And Robert Wright's book goes into how this is, we don't have the exact analogy to what our ancestors were thinking 50,000 years ago, 500,000 years ago. The closest we have is the hunter-gatherer societies that still survive today in South America and Africa and other parts of the world, and ones that were studied by anthropologists, you know, back in earlier times and earlier centuries.
So comparing, extrapolating what we know about modern day hunter-gatherers, do the pictorial pictographs, the pictures that they left, the art they left behind, does that kind of match up with the modern hunter-gatherer societies, like in their belief systems? Do we see
that's parallels? A great question, and I don't think we know for sure. I don't think anybody knows for certain, and maybe there's anthropologists out there who could answer the question better than I am. But as far as I know, it helps inform what their guesswork is, and that's probably as close as we can get.
Got it.
In my thought.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, no worries. So shamans, and I have a picture here of some shaman in, I believe it's Mongolia or Siberia, dancing around a campfire. And I also have a picture of a South American shaman with a really gorgeous headdress and a necklace set in the jungles of South America. It's fascinating to see what this next step was in evolution, because now we had religious specialists for the first time. And some of them relied on an impressive array of magician's tricks, showmanship, ventriloquism, sleight of hand, using assistants to spy on potential clients' ailments. And rival shamans were ruthless to one another in exposing fakes. And again, I do want to point out, this is based on what anthropologists have observed in the last, you know, few hundred years, as long as people have been doing anthropological studies on these cultures. In many cultures, drugs and hallucinogens were employed, as well as fasting or sleeplessness, and even self-mutilation. Others had a more neurotic bent, hearing voices, or even simply just having a moody artistic temperament. And in any case, whether 100% sincere or totally calculating, many shamans were able to turn their powers into material gain and or political powers. And this feels like a good time to point out that this is such a nutshell version of this talk. I highly recommend Robert Wright's book and Daniel Dennett's book, the two books in the beginning, who give just example after example of this and really great in-depth discussion of all these periods and all these examples and how they're supported by archaeology and when text arrives, how they're supported by textual evidence as well.
What were those two books again? The slide went by really fast.
Sure. I've got them right here, actually. It's Robert Wright's book, if you can see it. I don't know if you can see it or not. It's The Evolution of God by Robert Wright and Breaking the Spell by Daniel Dennett. There's some other books that I worked on in this talk, but those two were by far the biggest, and I highly recommend them both. The range of sincerity in shamans, at least in the shaman cultures that we've studied, is fascinating. And you get a real mix of rogues and scoundrels and apparently very sincere shamans. But in any case, from shamans, we go to the next level of religious evolution, and that is chieftains. And this is about 7,000 years ago. And the picture I'm showing here is of a Polynesian chieftain, and the guy standing next to him is probably a shaman for the purposes of this talk, but we don't really know who it is. But there's definitely a chieftain, could be in Hawaii, could be in Tonga, could be in Fiji, could be anywhere in Polynesia. I tend to think this was taken in, this picture is supposed to be Hawaii. The next change came with the invention of agriculture. And with that, the virtues of religion and the character of their gods would start to change. Chieftains were the most advanced social organization 7,000 years ago. And it seems to be the standard next step from hunter-gatherer societies to early ancient states, such as Egypt and Shang China. More recently, they've been observed in Polynesia, Africa, and the Americas. And of course, all of these have many differences, but one major commonality is a reliance on the supernatural. Their political and their religious structures are deeply intertwined. They have many, many gods, and every vocational niche that has arisen now has its own god. And every serious enterprise, like canoe building, is a religious affair involving detailed rituals, prayers, and ceremony. Crime and punishment were meted out by the chief's armed retainers or by ghosts who frowned upon bad behavior and could punish wrongdoers with disease, hauntings, and in places like Tonga, by shark attacks. Two key principles undergirded Polynesian life: tapu, which we know from the English word taboo, and mana. Tapu were the forbidden things, such as casual contact with the chief, who after all was descended from the gods, and therefore drenched with mana, the divine power of chieftain kings. Commoners groveled before their king, averting their eyes. Some were not even permitted to hear his voice. On some islands, his spokesman, a talking chief, issued the pronouncements. Human sacrifice was common. In the Society Islands, candidates for sacrifice included, I love this, prisoners of war, blasphemers, and any person obnoxious to the chief or priest. Now, despite all this, rulership did have some chief checks and balances. In Tahiti, unhappy priests and elites could strip a persistently despotic chief of his power. And competition with other chieftains also could keep chieftains honest. Consistent failures were also a sign that a chief had lost favor of the gods. And Polynesian culture did develop at least one science. Captain Cook noted that the Tahitian navigator / priest / astronomers tracked heavenly bodies with more precision than their European astronomers could. Then we come to about 30,000 years ago, the ancient city-states. And I have a picture here of what could be Ur, what could be Ugarit, a giant Mesopotamian city on water. Agriculture allowed civilizations to grow bigger and bigger into the next step of social organization. Now state-level societies were bigger than chiefdoms, with more elaborate government bureaucracies and a new, more advanced information technology, usually a full-fledged writing system. But like chieftains, religion still pervaded life. Gods of city-states like ancient Mesopotamia, like Egypt, China, and other places were basically human, warts and all, but with supernatural powers. And again, with so many new vocations, there were more gods than ever. Gods for farmers, gods for scribes, merchants, craftsmen, brewers, brickmakers, livestock pens, you name it. Mesopotamian scribes conducted a census of the gods at one point and came up with a list of nearly 2,000 names in their various pantheons. In Aztec society, even robbers had their own god. Mayans had a god of suicide. Egyptians had 8 deities in charge of the stomach, liver, lungs, and intestines, 2 gods per organ. And what about neighboring gods? As polytheists, tolerance wasn't an insurmountable problem for the ancient city-states. If you traded with another city or entered a military alliance with them, you might even want to go beyond mere tolerance and actively embrace their god too. This is what appeared to happen in ancient Mesopotamia. The gods of different cities coalesced into a regional pantheon. In fact, they became family as the theologians worked out a divine family tree. And having an interrelated family of gods strengthened the bonds between cities. When this got bigger still, And when empires conquered people with different cultures, languages, and gods, then there were other options. When Sargon of Akkad conquered the Sumerian city of Nippur, he convinced the local priest to agree that his victory was the will of their god Enlil. He also set up his daughter as a high priestess of the Sumerian goddess Inanna, and then announced that Inanna and the Akkadian goddess Ishtar were one and the same. The Romans also made great use later of this, hey, your god is really my god trick. If you've ever been to the city of Bath in Somerset, England, the Roman Britain city of Aqua Sulis fused the local Celtic river goddess Solus with a Roman goddess to become Solus Minerva. And when the Romans conquered the Greeks, of course, the native Greek gods became renamed as Roman gods. All right, but in one corner of the world, somewhere in the sticks stuck between the great empires, some remarkable religious ideas would be coming. Fun fact, in ancient Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, there was no word for religion. Like the societies before it, supernatural world and natural world were one and the same. But we're not talking about monotheism yet, because early Hebrew history is soaked in polytheism. In fact, the word that is often used in the Bible for the Lord, Elohim, is actually a plural word that originally meant the gods. And there's some very interesting verses in the Old Testament where it's talking about the gods, not the God. Archaeology more than confirms this. In fact, there's been hundreds of figures of naked fertility goddesses, for example, at every late monarchic site in Judea. And even the Bible talks about Baal, Asherah, the heavenly host, Milcom of Ammon, Chemosh of Moab, Ashtoreth of Sidon, all being worshipped in Judea. Jeremiah complains that there's as many deities worshipped in Judah as there are cities, and as many altars to Baal in Jerusalem as stalls in the marketplace bazaar. And cultic objects dedicated to Baal, Asherah, and the host of heaven were installed not just in the high places in the country, but installed in the temple in Jerusalem. Ezekiel even observed with disapproval that women were weeping for Tammuz at the north gate of the temple, and men in the inner court were bowing in worship to the sun, turning their backs on Jehovah, literally and figuratively. But who was Yahweh before he was Yahweh? There's some very interesting verses that talk about this. When God first meets Moses at the burning bush, it says, God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai. But by my name Yahweh, I did not make myself known to them. Exodus 6, 2-3. He never gives a reason for his name change, but it needs to be noted that before the word El meant God with a small g in biblical Hebrew, it was the proper name of the supreme Canaanite God. And all the references to such as the children of the Lord and the sons of God, and in names like Daniel, Samuel, Nathaniel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and of course, the name Israel, all originally appeared to have referred to El, the supreme Canaanite God. But Yahweh picked up DNA from other gods too. When the Bible sings his praises in Psalm 74, it sounds very much like it's talking about someone else. Psalm 74 says, you divided the sea. The Hebrew word for that is yam, by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the water. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. Yahweh's biggest rival in the Old Testament, you probably recognize. He's the storm god Baal, who also subjugated Yam, the sea god, and slew the multi-headed dragon Lotan, or in Hebrew, Leviathan. In other verses of the Bible, Yahweh defeats death, or Mot. Also happens to be the name of the god of death who Baal fought. And strangely enough, Yahweh at some points loses his wrath against the rivers and rages against the sea. Why is he so mad at water? The context of the verses don't tell us, but they make more sense if the Hebrew words for river and sea, Nahar and Yam, are translated as proper names, Nahar and Yam, the supernatural beings that Baal fought. And there are other places in the Old Testament, and there's quite a few, I've skipped over a whole bunch, where it sounds like Yahweh has stolen from hymns to Baal. like those points we just mentioned. And even miracles like the parting of the Red Sea have roots in Ugaritic Baal mythology too. If you haven't already, you might want to see my talk, Sexy Violence, Violent Sex, The Weird Ass Morality of the Bible on YouTube for more discussion of that, of polytheism and human sacrifice in the Bible.
David,
now, yes.
Are you saying the EL at the end of Daniel came from Elohim and all those other gods?
That is what I'm saying. And Elohim was originally a plural. Yeah, yeah. And we have that verse where he says, yeah, I introduced myself to those guys as El Shaddai or El in the highest or El of the mountains. But by my name, Yahweh, I did not make myself known. Why? Just happy coincidence that it just happens to be the name of this other pantheon's god. And I shouldn't say this other pantheon. It was the supreme pantheon of the Canaanites. And spoiler alert, Israelites were Canaanites.
And would be the same be true for Michael? Because that's an angel.
Yep. Yep. And just about every angel you can think of has got EL at the end. Raphael, Ezekiel, Ezekiel, Michael. The names just go on and on and on and on and on. And yep, every single one of them originally seems to be from El. Which is completely understandable because, again, the Hebrews, as it turns out, I am getting ahead of the story possibly, Abraham didn't come from Ur. Moses didn't lead the people into the promised land. These people were Canaanites from Canaan. Apparently, just recently I seem to be remembering that DNA-wise, they've also confirmed this, that the Israelites and the Canaanites were the same people. And here's another interesting fun fact. Historian Martin Noth theorizes that it wasn't just the gods who became lumped together as family. And incidentally, Baal, Yahweh's biggest rival, originally seemed to be just another son of El, like Yahweh, and that they bounce up and down the hierarchy of pantheon as these things get interpreted and reinterpreted. But Martin Noth theorizes it wasn't just the gods who became lumped together this way. He thinks that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob were all the founding fathers of different tribes. And as those tribes unified, their forefathers were woven into a single family line. Maybe that's true, maybe that's not. But what we definitely know is that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all those guys, their backstory does not actually exist as told in the Bible. And of course, as we all know, Yahweh is a jealous God, which only makes sense if he wasn't the only God. He was just our God, if you were a Hebrew. Monolatry. Is, of course, the worship of the worship of your God above all others, like henotheism, where you're not denying that the other gods exist, they're just not your God. And there's plenty of verses in the Old Testament still that point out that the ancient Hebrews did not deny that there were other gods. He just wasn't our God. Joshua 23:16 says, if you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he enjoined on you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to him, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, blah, 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 blah. The Israelites and Judges did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, silly Hebrews, forgetting that the Lord their God and worshiping the Baals and the Asherahs. And we see that pattern in the Old Testament repeated point by point over and over and over again, especially in Judges, where those silly Hebrews, you know, are complaining to Moses, or they forget that God is the real God, even though he just did a miracle 5 minutes before. And they are all constantly running off to worship other gods. And of course, Exodus 20 says in the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me, or beside me is another way that's interpreted sometimes. But it doesn't say there are no other gods. That comes much later with people like Isaiah, but I am definitely getting ahead of the story here. Monotheism turns out to come and go in ancient Israel. After the Babylonian conquest and the exile, the Israelites picked up new religious ideas from Persian Zoroastrianism, including the idea of a paradise after death. Paradise, after all, is a Persian word for the good, and a fiery eternal punishment for the wicked, the eventual apocalyptic end of the world, and a whole slew of angel and demon lore all came directly from Persia, and other stuff as well. For instance, in the Old Testament, we don't see a lot of people being possessed by demons, and that causes their discomfort. But by the time we get to the New Testament, that's the number one diagnosis for everything from leprosy to insanity to you name it. They got a demon in it. And one of the things Jesus does is he's an exorcist. but eventually, after the return to the promised land, a Yahweh-only religious faction came out on top. And that's a very long story being put very short. And they set out to rewrite Israelite history to make it seem that Yahweh had always been Israel's only God all along. I mean that Yahweh was the only God, period. And none of those Johnny-come-lately foreign import gods were even real. A world full of gods. I've got a picture here. Does anybody recognize who this is? Any guesses?
Looks like Mars, maybe?
He definitely has what's called a Frisian helmet, which I believe is associated with Mars. But he's actually a Greek. Does that help?
Ares?
Oh, okay. Achilles?
He's not a god. He's actually a man.
Oh, Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great. Yeah.
God, he's ripped, man. I wish I had his
eight-pack.
He
was rocking. It's ironic that we have Alexander the Great in a very large sense to thank for Christianity in a direct but kind of stretched sort of way. Because meanwhile, outside of Israel, the rest of the world was swimming in gods. And Alexander the Great didn't depose the gods of the people he subjugated. Instead, he incorporated them into a super pantheon for his sprawling, multicultural, cosmopolitan empire. And we can talk more about that, but I'm going to keep pushing ahead so we don't go down too many rabbit holes. During the Hellenistic Age, the time of Alexander the Great and his successors, who broke into different successor states, a certain sexy new idea, actually a very ancient one, took hold in religion. Stuffy old pantheons like Mount Olympus were out. The newest thing were mystery religions, a whole slew of cults all dedicated to a different pagan god or goddess, now rebooted as a personal savior. Where are we going with that? I don't remember. There we go. Hellenistic era. And to make a very long story very short, one particular mystery faith, the Jewish version, began to take off in the first century. And after centuries of languishing as an obscure movement, finally took off when the Roman emperor chose Christianity as his favored faith. It's a little further than I want to go. And from there, we get our big time monotheism. And monotheism takes over from polytheism and dominates the show on religion for the rest of time. But there's one interesting thing about not just monotheism, but all the major religions that have survived to today. Oh, there it is, Christianity evolving. There we go. And that's the dirty secret of most, if not all, religions. And it definitely is the top 10 religions. And pardon me if you were here last time when I spoke about this at the last talk, but I'll just do a quick recap. Here's some interesting things we find when we look at the top 10 religions. Christianity. So Christianity began ostensibly with the death of Jesus in around the year 30, 33. We don't really know for sure because, like every other aspect of his life, we can't really pin down any dates with any certainty. About 20 years after that, we get the earliest Christian writings, the Pauline writings, the genuine Pauline writings. About 20 years after that, after the war with Rome, our earliest gospel, Mark, first appears. And from
David, what is Pauline? Is that the Apostle Paul?
That's the Apostle Paul. Apostle Paul.
My ears, it sounds like a woman
right,
named Pauline.
Right. I apologize for the use of jargon.
That's why I'm here.
Of the 13 letters attributed to Paul, only half of them are actually believed to be by Paul. And those, in fact, are clearly have been re-edited and are probably mashups of other letters. And then there's a whole slew of other writings. In fact, most of the New Testament, including all the other epistles, are forgeries, almost certainly forgeries, or based very loosely maybe on some eyewitness. But I'm very comfortable saying that they're all forgeries. Our earliest gospel is written in the 70s, and the other three follow sometime afterwards. Luke was definitely after 95. John was probably in the early second century. Matthew was probably, you know, 10 to 20 years after Mark. But we can't say for sure, because up until the mid-late second century, we don't have the earliest gospels. We don't have the earliest Pauline letters. We only have tiny fragments, most about the size of a credit card. And it's not until about towards the end, getting towards the third century, that we actually have full or even near full complete books of the New Testament. And it's not until 100 years after that, in the fourth century, that we have our earliest complete New Testament collections. And that's Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus. Now, the funny thing about those books is they don't agree with each other. Vaticanus has books that Sinaiticus has, and Sinaiticus has books that Vaticanus doesn't have. And our Bibles have books that they don't have, and they have books that we don't have. Here's another interesting thing about early Christianity. There's a bit of a problem, because as I mentioned, we only have these New Testament fragments, which means that for the first 150 to 200 years of Christianity, we don't know what the scriptures originally said. We have no way of knowing. We have nothing. All we know is that all the existing surviving fragments and books and texts of the New Testament that we have differ from each other so greatly that no two New Testament manuscripts match each other at all. For the most part, that's just because of spelling errors and mistakes from scribes. But we don't care about that. That's not the worrisome thing. That's fine. That's understandable. What's more upsetting, for Christians anyway, is that the deliberate changes, where they've actually deliberately changed one meaning to something else. And worst of all, even devout Bible-believing expert scholars who are competent in this don't know which is the right reading. They don't know which is the original. And the sad fact is that even if we magically had Paul put his letters into a vault and we just discovered it right now and they're fresh off from his hand, we wouldn't know that. We would just see, oh, here's an interesting variant on a Pauline letter or on a gospel. And it would just be one more of the variants that we have. So that's Christianity. There's a lot more reasons to be troubled with Christianity, and I've written four books about that, making the argument that Jesus probably did not exist at all. In fact, I'm going to say it, the guy did not exist at all. I don't even see how he could have existed, knowing what we know, including things like the blackout period and what people wrote about him and what people outside Christianity wrote about him or didn't write about him. But here's the funny thing about that. I've spent talks and talks and books and decades of my career talking about that problem for Christianity. But one of the things that surprised me most when I first published my book, Nailed, was not that the Christians hated it. Was not that it was... Back up. I'm starting to go off on another tangent from another talk altogether. One of the other things that surprised me the most was how often Buddhists would come up to me and ex-Muslims would come up to me and say, you know what, we're having the same conversations in our circles about Buddha and Muhammad, which blew my mind until the ex-Muslims started telling me why they felt that way about Muhammad. Seventh century, how can he be fake? This is how come. So Muhammad is believed to have lived in the year 570 to 632. Right after his death, the caliphate of Islam was established by the government of Mecca, and they set about conquering the Middle Eastern world as far as Syria and Byzantium, the Arab conquest began. And 20 years after that, according to tradition, the Quran was finished and distributed. And then much later, in the early 8th century, we have the first mention of the Quran outside of Islam. Actually, not even outside of Islam, the first mention of the Quran, full stop. In the mid-8th century, 125 years after the death of Muhammad, we get the first complete bio of Muhammad. And I should point out, it's not just his complete bio, but a whole family tree of all his relatives who also formed their own sects of Islam. But again, as I was saying, there's a problem with all this. And when we look a little closer, it turns out that during the reign of Caliph Abd al-Malik, 60 years after the death of Muhammad, that is when we first start hearing about Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, and indeed the religion called Islam. Before that, there's no Arab writings that refer to it as that, and there's no conquered peoples from the Arab conquest that refer to it that way. In the year 696, Islamic beliefs first appear on coins and inscriptions. But before this, we have at least three coins that appear with crosses, Islamic coins with crosses on them. We have Islamic minarets that have crosses on top of them. During the same time in the late part of the 7th century, Arabic becomes the primary written language of the Arabian Empire, beating Syriac and Greek. And common Muslim practices, which we think should have been there all along, like reciting from the Quran during mosque prayers, praying to Mecca, all that, begin. And I just had a thought of another one that has popped up, and it's come and gone. Well, maybe it'll occur to me later. Something interesting happens. The caliph claims in passing to have collected the Quran together, something that a caliph, Uthman, was supposed to have done 40 years prior to this. And multiple hadiths, and hadiths are the traditional oral traditions about Islam, report that his governor of Iraq, Hajjaj ibn Yusuf, edited and distributed the Quran. Again, something that was supposed to have happened a generation or more before. So it becomes a lot, and there's a lot more we can say. There's a great book, Ibn Warraq mentions this in his book, Why I'm Not a Muslim. Robert Stewart, I believe is the name. Robert Spencer has written about this in Did Muhammad Exist? Amazing, mind-blowing work. And it's based on the work of other scholars. This is not even new stuff. So that's Islam. But let's talk about Judaism. I kind of gave away the game earlier when I mentioned that Abraham and the patriarchs are not historical. And neither is Moses or Joshua. In fact, the Exodus and the conquest of Canaan is not historical at all. Now, Saul and David and Jonathan, let me just put it this way. Once we get to later, the 9th century, say, then we have historical figures who are on more solid ground. The Omrides dynasty, the most famous members of that being Ahab and Jezebel. Amos and Hosea, the biblical writers, and King Hezekiah, all who appear in the Old Testament, show up around the 8th century, King Josiah in the 7th century. And of course, the Babylonian conquest, 586, and the post-exilic period around 440 BC. All those dates on the right-hand side are pretty well established. Everything on the left-hand, not so much. In fact, we have absolutely no evidence of the Exodus or the conquest. And when I say we have no evidence, what I mean is, we have evidence that those things did not happen. Not only a lack of evidence, all the evidence points to something completely different, which we could also say about David and Solomon's reign. And the same two archaeologists who wrote that book, The Bible on Earth, which I highly recommend, also wrote this book, David and Solomon, talking about how the real David and Solomon, those 10th century figures, were nothing like the kingdoms that we see depicted in the Deuteronomic history of the Old Testament. And the list goes on. We'd mentioned Buddhists talking about this. Well, in the 10th century, of course, was the death of Buddha. according to the Eastern tradition. If you ask the Tibetans, no, he died in the 9th century. Early 20th century historians were sure that he lived in the 6th century. Another tradition put him in the 5th century. Later 20th century historians put him later in the 5th century. And around the 3rd century BC, these are all BCE dates, several edicts of Ashok, the emperor of India, I believe, mentioned the Buddha. But it's not until the 2nd century AD/CE that the Buddhacarita, the first biography of the Buddha, was written in the early 22nd century. Excuse me. So again, not to beat a dead horse, but we're seeing a pattern of all these being once upon a time right out of the box. And I'll quickly go through some of these. Taoisms, Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, was said to have lived in the 6th or 5th century, but virtually every fact of his life is in dispute. And the prominent view among scholars today is that his Tao Te Ching is a compilation of multiple authors over a century or two. Confucius, Master Kong, aka Confucius or Confuci, is said to have been a 5th century BCE figure, but his earliest biography appears 400 years after his death. And the Analects attributed to him and other ancient traditions that he supposedly collected was actually composed sometime during the Warring States period after his death and reached its final form centuries later during the Han Dynasty. The Baha'i faith and Mormonism, and let's be clear, Mormonism is not in the top 10 of world religions, but it's one of my favorites. The Baha'i faith is a spinoff of Babism, or the Babi faith, itself a spinoff of Shia Islam. And Mormonism is a spinoff of Christianity, though it's worth noting that its founders include the mythical prophet Mormon and the angel Moroni. Shinto and Hinduism are interesting because they're considered two of the oldest religions in the world, and historically, Hinduism is considered a fusion of multiple Indian cultures over millennia, while Shinto emerged from the beliefs and practices of prehistoric Japan. And so there is no single founder figure of Hinduism or Shinto. Jainism, my good friend Hemant Mehta, if you know him, the friendly atheist, bless his heart, he was raised a Jain and he has very fond memories of Jainism, even though he's a happy atheist and could not, and has plenty of problems with Jainism. But when you look for just strictly mythological business, look at what we're talking about with Jainism. Millions and millions of years ago, BCE, Rishabhanatha, the first of 24 Jain Tantakaras teachers, is born. He lives for 8.2 million purva years. As we all know, one purva year equals 8,400 years squared in Western reckoning. He's also 4,950 feet tall during all those 8.2 million purva years. Well, flipping all the way back through the 24 different Jain teachers, the 23rd Tirthankara, Parshvanatha, is born. He's 13 and a half feet tall and lives for 100 years. In the 6th century, around 599, Mahavira, the 24th and final one, is born. But for some reason, in the 2 centuries after that, around 300 BC, his teachings were gradually lost, and we had to re-find them later or re-establish them centuries later. Sikhism. Now, before I set up the first time I used this talk, I hadn't even planned to use Sikhism, but I got curious since I started collecting everybody, I might as well see what Sikhism had for its historical founding. And I really was not expecting it to follow the pattern. I didn't expect this to be a universal pattern. And I thought if anybody broke the pattern, it would be Sikhism, because Sikhism is only barely 500 years old. Columbus discovered America before the founder of Sikhism died. And after him, there was a group of 10, the 10 gurus, and we got their dates there. And those dates are all pretty well established. That it seemed to me that you've got a pretty good case for historicity. And so did my Sikh friends who I spoke to about this. And then I dug a little deeper, and it turns out that Sikh history seems to start in the 17th century with the fifth of these 10 gurus, Guru Arjan, who compiles the first collection of Sikh scripture, the Adi Granth, in 1604. And there's five different theories on how this process went about. the first one basically says, oh, it just happened the way our scriptures always said it did. And the last three scriptures are variations on the fact that Gur Arjan compiled it himself with the help of a couple people and maybe some other people after him. In any case, 50 or to 80 years after the death of Guru Nanak, the founder of Sikhism, stories of his life begin to appear, and many more start to show up in this bard period in 17th century, in the 18th century, in the early 19th century. And these stories, how do we put it? These stories are clear, unflinching bullshit. It's his conversations with a fish. It's him meeting this other mythical figure over here. The historians regard them as being basically devoid of any factual content whatsoever, which Sikhs do not like to hear at all. In fact, another commonality against all these religions is religions hate it when you look into the origins of their religions. They really hate it. In the 18th century, we get the final edition of Sikh scriptures 100 years after that first part, the Guru Granth Sahib. And just getting away from religion shortly, I just want to point out there's other questionable figures in history, like Homer, like Isaiah, like Aesop, Pythagoras, like Lycurgus of Sparta, a famous lawgiver in the Grecian world. And even more modern than that, folk heroes like King Arthur and Robin Hood and St. Nicholas, the supposed real figure that Santa Claus is based on, his figure has also got a very dodgy history. The Swiss folk hero William Tell, completely made up. General Ned Ludd, who led the 19th century Luddite movement, which was a real thing from 1811, 1816, never existed at all, completely mythological. And mythological heroes still appear today. The Q-level clearance patriot, if you can see in the sign, our buffalo wing job here says Q sent me. Well, Q turns out to be probably two Reddit editors, expats in the Philippines. And yet we've seen what that damage that's caused by believing that this person was really Steve Bannon or really some high up member of the secret government that's gonna get Trump back in power. So let's get some zoom out and get some overview. Does religion do more harm than good? Eric, is this a time where we can pull out the poll and see what people think, or is that something we need to do afterwards?
No, we can definitely pull that poll up.
Yeah. Well, let's look into that real fast. Sure, let's do.
Okay. So the first question, we have about 3% said they have a Jewish background. The majority, about 84%, says Christianity. We have 1% that's for both Islam and Buddhism, 2% for Hinduism, 3% for other religion, and 7% for no religious tradition.
Yeah. And again, I just want to say before we go on, if you came out of any of those religious traditions I talked about tonight, and I stepped on your toes for you believing it, believe me, I'm stepping on my own religious tradition just as hard and for the same reasons. I don't think we were dumb for believing in the religion traditions we grew up in.
Thanks. Yeah, perfect. And then the second question, do you think religion is a force for blank? 5% said good, 41% said bad, 50% said it depends, and 4% said no opinion.
I think that tracks pretty well with what I expected, actually. Let me stop, get out of here. I don't want to click that. Religions of peace or war. Just some things to think about in weighing that question. There's an interesting thing that happens as religions grow, and we see it in the city state period, and we definitely see it with the rise of monotheism. When religious groups see outsiders as rivals or persecutors, their scriptures tend to be read more hostile and unforgiving. But when they recognize that they can do business with a new group, they're more willing to reinterpret those same scriptures in new ways that allow for win-win scenarios. And as religions mature through various stages and grow to encompass more and more different groups, their definition of the in-group tends to grow in the direction of an inclusive universal brotherhood and sisterhood. know, it takes a while to get there. Robert Wright sees two main schools of thought, and it's interesting to be reading his book because as we go from it's a cycle of stages of different religions, he sees the pros and cons of these two groups. And I need to get rid of this poll to read it myself here. Okay. He sees functionalists seeing religion as serving the interests of society as a whole. So even religious elements that may seem extreme or dysfunctional to outsiders have virtues and benefits to individuals and or the religious group as a whole. And they think religion serves society broadly, providing reassurance and hope, overcoming our national selfishness with communal cohesion, et cetera. And just getting back to Daniel Dennett and Breaking the Spell and other authors, people have done some really interesting research on what to us outside of particular religion looks horrific. And just for example, not to pick on Islam, but the festival of Asherah, where they take scimitars and they beat themselves with it until they draw blood. I saw a video where I saw a man do that and split his backbone so much that I could see his spine before somebody stopped him. Keep whacking himself with a scimitar, and yet there are sociologists who say that things like that—that's an extreme example—but things that have a high cost value, opt-in value, makes it very difficult for people to give it up. The early history of Mormonism is a totally excellent example of this. When a religion doesn't get persecuted in the beginning, it doesn't seem to have as much cohesion. And a lot of new religious movements that aren't persecuted tend to just go away. But when outside forces act on him, it's like a hammer to to an iron on an anvil. It coalesces, it strengthens them because they're bound together. And there's other ways that happens. For instance, apocalyptic sects who predict the end of the world, Jehovah's Witnesses know what I'm talking about. They get that wrong again and again and again and again. And every time they get it wrong and the due date comes and goes, they lose some people, but most of them double down and reinterpret and look forward to the next time the world's going to end. And that cycle continues and continues and continues because they're in too deep to just give up on their religion. Now, on the other side, there's cynics, which he likes to call Marxists, not because they're communists, but because they argue that religious social structures tend to serve the powerful as a tool of social control that numbs people to their exploitation when it's not scaring them to death. And I'm not ashamed to say that I tend towards the cynic argument, but in actual fact, I'm going too far. I don't want to go there just yet. I'm a firm it depends-er, because for any religion that survives, they have to have the functionalist and the cynic. Both those values have to be there. If they're not serving the interests of society as a whole, they're not going to survive. If the elites don't profit from them, they probably won't get started in the first place. Probably will continue to evolve in new and interesting ways. Hopefully, they will get to that point where they are starting to embrace other religious groups in that win-win scenario. Or they could all go atheist, and that would be fine with me too. But one thing, no matter what happens, we will be in the same place, considering no matter what we know our about the universe around us, the more we know, the bigger our ignorance grows, and in an unending cycle. So we'll always be wondering about our place in the universe. And some things about religion will never change. A Bluma joke, but there it is. I think that is the last of the, that's the end of my talk. Just a quick commercial for shameless plugs, if you will. If you enjoyed this talk, you'll probably enjoy Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Exists at All, or its sequel, Jesus Mything in Actions, Volume 1, 2, and 3. Nailed just points out the top 10 ways that Christianity's story just does not hold water. And Jesus Mything in Action shows how it looks like Christianity appeared and all our evidence for that, both inside and outside of Christianity. And coming soon from the same series, The Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion, who also brought you the book, The Mormons, is Sex and Violence and Weirdness in the Bible, working title. Don't know when that's going to come out. It won't be coming out this year probably, but I'm going to get it out as soon as I possibly can. And I'm very much looking forward to that. If you've seen my talk, Sexy Violence, Violent Sex, The Weird-Ass Morality of the Bible, that is the germ from which this book is growing. And it's super fun. The problem is keeping it short and not trying to include every single wackadoodle thing in the Bible, because I just want to use the creme de la creme. And on a completely selfish and self-serving note, has nothing to do with religion. Actually, kind of does, actually, when I think about it. My wife, Dana, and I, Dana is also a horror writer and a urban fantasy writer. We wrote a trilogy, and the third book is just out. So this whole trilogy is now available for everybody to read. It's called Time Shards. It's a science fiction adventure romp that involves the timeline shattering, and our gang of heroes, the ragtag game of heroes, are actually from different times and places. And they all have to work together in this post-apocalyptic landscape where over here it could be 5 million BC, over here it could be 1492. There could be a robot around the corner. There could be a dinosaur around the corner. They don't know. And they have to try to save the world. And they do so, maybe, over the course of three books. And I really do love this series. If you're a history fan or a science fiction fan, I think you'll enjoy them. And sorry to be so shameless about them, but these books just came out. The third just came out, and I'm so proud of them. Because usually when I write a nonfiction book, I want to follow it with a fiction book, because you don't have to worry about footnotes. You don't have to worry about research. You just have to make everything up. Well, in this case, we had to make everything up, and we had to do the research, just like we would for a historical book. So it was the worst of both worlds, and it was the most challenging book I think either of us has ever written, but it's also my favorite series. And I just really love the way it came together. I love the characters, and I love the fun, and I love the take on religion and religious ideas and attitudes throughout all three books. Oh, that's enough. I've got to stop. Shameless. I think that's the last of that.
David, you had me at history and science fiction.
Yay!
They sound fantastic. I'll have to check them out.
Thank you. And I'll go back to these, because that's a little more on point. But let's open it up to questions. And again, I apologize. This finally came together scarce minutes before we went on air. And so it's not quite as polished as I like in my talks, but I'm really happy with the information that came across. And I'm really glad so many people are here to see it.
Amazing.
This was a great presentation. I'll echo Sherry's sentiments as well. Now, you did your shameless promoting. Can all of this information be found on your website?
Yes, it can be found on my website, davidfitzgerald.org. It can be found on Facebook. And I'm always happy to be emailed by people with questions that I missed or didn't get to at everybodylovesdave@gmail.com. Excellent. And it's so great to see faces that was with me this weekend at the Global Center for Religious Resource. Yes, I see our friend from Sweden, Olaf.
This was fantastic. And Sherry and I were kind of messaging back and forth in the chat. Like, we were so grateful this will be up on YouTube, because there was so much information, and you only get like the top level the first time through, and the second time through, it'll be able to get even more. So thank you so much for doing this for us.
My pleasure. Amazing. And again, I highly recommend that book, The Evolution of God by Robert Wright. Goes much deeper into everything I talked about tonight. Yeah.
I was collecting the resources as you were talking, so I'll go ahead and drop them into the chats here for both which is Zoom here, and also
look Discord. At that list.
Karen Armstrong's book, that actually was something I read before I deconverted, and it really kind of gave me this worldview, because when I was in my old belief system, it was so narrowly focused and I was told everybody else was wrong. But when I saw how the concept of God had changed over time, it really opened my eyes up.
You know, it's funny because it's the evolution of all these things that I think is the most damning thing about it. Because if you just lay out where these ideas came from, it's so much harder to take them seriously when you realize they weren't there from the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Completely agree with that.
Another book that really kind of helped me too was Noah Before the Flood by Irving Finkel. And he talks about how he talks about the Epic of Gilgamesh. He can read cuneiform like nobody's business, and got like this amazing tablet that told the rest of the Epic of Gilgamesh, and just went into the history about how when the folks in Babylonia sacked Jerusalem and brought a bunch of the Jewish scribes over, that Epic of Gilgamesh got incorporated into the Torah. And it was just so fascinating to know.
You have just hit on something that's going to be part of my Sex and Violence in the Bible book that I did not mean to be telling people, but the fact that the Torah is so much younger than we've ever suspected is, for me, a mind-blowing revelation. Yeah. And Russell Gmurkin's work on this, when I came across it last May, it actually threw a monkey wrench in my book, because all my framework that I had set up, it's like, wow, it is gone. This is all gone. And I had to start from scratch, and I'm still in the process of getting all that together.
Which can be a good thing at times.
Yeah, it's fascinating. That's the thing about this. It's like, yeah, Christianity is not important. Jesus isn't important, but man, this is fascinating. And it's like, it's really cool to see where religions actually came from. And the thing I love about this talk is, and it's not just our religion, it's everybody else's religion who suffers from the exact same bullshittery, if you will. Yeah.
And there was another thing that I saw too. There was this organization who did a giant poster that tracked like the evolutions of world religion. It was like a
I have it. I meant to actually include it in my talk, in my slide, and I'll send it to you. And remind me
I got the link in the resources.
Remind me about Noah Before the Flood, because the whole Epic of Gilgamesh influence on Noah's story is always fascinating. Do you remember when the movie Noah came out recently?
Yeah, with Russell Crowe, and it was aliens.
Here's the thing. I expected to hate it, but in fact, I hated it. And I hated it for the opposite reason that I thought I would hate it. And I loved it for the opposite reason I did. The thing I loved about it, I made up a fake Onion headline. It said, when all the Christians were saying, this is not biblical enough, it said, Sumerians say the story of Noah is not the Epic of Gilgamesh enough. and the fact is, even the Epic of Gilgamesh is just one of several antecedents to the Noah story. It's like there's like six or seven stages before we get to the Noah story: Akkadian, Sumerian, Babylonian.
Well, Sherry, do you have anything to add before I kind of go into the questions?
My head is spinning. There's
my book.
Oh, there's just so many new things that you've mentioned in a short period of time that I had no idea about. And so my brain's just exploded.
Brain's done. Yeah. I love to blow your brain, Sherry.
I've definitely done that. My God.
And you know what's the thing? The scariest thing about making a talk like this is I think, oh, they're atheists. They already know all this already. And, you know, and so many times, you know, I'm shocked by how much our fellow atheists do know. I mean, really solid biblical scholarship stuff, much more than I do, you know. And yet when I actually am able to show something that blows my mind and blows up, and they've never heard it, that's what keeps me going. That's my bread and butter.
David, not everybody here are atheists.
I apologize. Because I do tend to, it's the typical foot and mouth. when I was at a horror writers convention.
You're not
Utah,
a Skepticon or
I know
a secular
I know.
Student aligned or something.
I need to shut my mouth. When I was in Utah for a writers conference, I kept assuming that, you know, this guy dressed as Neo or this girl in hot pants who was filling up my kilt when I wasn't looking were all atheists like me. No, they're all Mormons. They were like, what? Are you kidding me? You know? Yeah, I was constantly putting my foot in my mouth. And I apologize to anybody here whose religious sensibilities I've stepped on. I don't mean to be mean to you, you know, love the sin, hate the sinner, something like that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Strike that, reverse it.
And the other thing too, David, this is going to be up on YouTube and it'll be available to folks of all beliefs too, just to kind of, if they're interested in learning about the evolution of their God. And
I'm sure they will be. I'm sure they'll really appreciate that. Yes.
Yeah.
They will tell me God's work I've done for them. Yes.
Well, let's get into some questions here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Sherry, I'll go ahead and take the first one and you can take the next one. The first question is something that I actually was wondering about too. Do you have any good book recommendations on Hinduism?
Oh, Hinduism.
That changed.
Short answer is no, I don't, though I do have the Bhagavad Gita and I want to say the Mahabharata I have as well. They're fascinating to read. It never occurred to me to try to debunk them because they're so, it's like trying to debunk the Garden of Eden story. It's like, it seems like the writers meant for you to know that this is a myth and a fable and an allegory. So it seems churlish to try to debunk it. Short answer, no.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. There is so much going on. I mean, the history of that. Jainism, the history, the scripture for all these Eastern religions blows my mind how just what a jungle every single one of them is.
Yeah.
There's another great question here from one in the chat. Great talk, David. There seems to be something deep in human psychology that needs religion and needs to invent it over and over. And believers aren't interested in evidence against their faith. I don't think we can defeat religion, but how can we best marginalize it?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny, before the Trump years, I was so optimistic. From 9/11 to the day Obama stepped down, it just seemed like atheism was just going to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. And I'd been telling people for years that Christianity is losing people, especially young people, they're just hemorrhaging them. But it occurred to me that the flip side of that is that we're losing it by the smartest ones first. So as the smarter people more and more leave Christianity, we're left with the nutty, crunchy, dumb, mean, scared core of Christianity. And that came roaring back 4 years ago, big time. And I never thought America would go off the rails as bad as it did. And I'm still recovering. I mean, that was 4 years of every single day thinking, oh my God, we are going to go full on fascist. And if it weren't for, and sorry to get political on this because we're talking about religion. Let's not burn all the bridges. But in fact, I'm going down a rabbit hole because I forgot what the original question was. What were we talking about? How do we
defeat religion? Yeah, or marginalize it?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. What I was going to say is when I was working for Secular Student Alliance, all the polls show that the young people in college at the time, and this is only about 5 or 6 years ago, religious levels were the lowest in human history since they'd been keeping track of religious levels. And at the time when I was working for them, it was an even split 33% of religious, not religious, spiritual, but not religious. And all those numbers just kept moving in our direction and away from the religious. And as far as I know, that trend has not stopped. It's still continuing. So there's still hope. But boy, talk about curveballs. What scares me the most about what's happened the last 4 years is the growth of these guys who are not just willfully ignorant, proudly ignorant. They embrace their ignorance, you know, and it's like, if I'm stupid enough, you can't affect me with your science and your logic. And it's working. It's working the most horrible, horrible medieval ways. We have flat earthers now on YouTube, proud of their, and they are not ashamed of their ignorance. Flat earthers. It's the 21st century.
Yeah, it's enough to make you despair.
Yeah, but don't despair. Don't despair because, you know, like Martin Luther King said, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. Same thing with science. And Robert Wright had an interesting message about this book. He kept trying to say that as he's tracking the evolution of history, the evolution of religion through history, it seems to be growing in inclusiveness, and it makes religions find ways to get along with each other or embrace each other. It makes you increase the in-group. And though there's so much downside to religion, you know,
with the getting more and more inclusive, that's more of like a marketing ploy.
And it is. But nonetheless, I mean, we're not having crusades right now. Muslims and Christians aren't killing each other in army-sized doses so much. And that's, for what it's worth, that is a step in the right direction. Mm. And I have a feeling the internet is going to really smack Islam in the ass before it knows it, because there are tons of women, and I used to get emails from them all the time, me and Richard Carrier and other people in the atheist movement, who they can't drive a car, they can't get a job, but they can stay home and watch anti-Christian videos on the internet all day long, and Islam loves it. And they haven't made the math yet that all those arguments for against Christianity were just as well against Islam.
Right.
So who knows how long before all that closet backlash comes.
Yeah.
And another hopeful sign, I mean, 100 years ago, they would kill a Westerner for going into the Kaaba in Medina, in Mecca. Now they have 24-hour live streams from the Kaaba. I just realized there was another. The Kaaba is one of the other things that didn't start with Islam, but started before Islam. One of the pre-Islamic things I meant to put into the slide, too.
I had that screenhouse before you forget.
I should say I'm not on cocaine. I'm not drunk, but I am. I've just come off a 2-day conference where I got very little sleep before, very little sleep during. Olaf knows what I'm talking about. And here we are now. And the fatigue poisons, I think, are starting to kick in, because at best in these, I mean, the rabbit holes I go down to fast and furious at the best of times. And I appreciate your indulgence for me, because this topic really excites me, and there's just a million things that keep popping up.
Are you saying that we're contributing to your habit?
You're my drug of choice. You are my drug of choice, beloveds.
We got another question here. In your opinion, are religious texts designed to be open for interpretation, or is that just something that is a part of the evolution of religions?
I'm going to answer that kind of sideways. I think religious texts, when they go through the process of becoming religious texts, the optimal thing they're looking for is that they need to be anonymous in the best of circumstances, and they need to be vague enough to be interpreted in a multitude of ways. The Old Testament does a better job of this than the New Testament. But when you have a writing that says something, and it's not, it's me, Ezekiel from Tel Aviv, telling you this, but it's just, it is written, like the Dothraki in Game of Thrones. It is known, this, you know, as the scriptures tell us, blah, 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 blah. You know, that anonymity gives it a power and a prestige. And as far as interpretation, I mean, you can read Paul all day long. That guy and many other New Testament writers, they are very strange writings indeed, and you can interpret it in a multitude of ways, and there are 30,000 Christian denominations taking their own spin on all these things, which is why I try to be careful. I try to keep in mind my Southern Baptist roots show when I thinking, oh, this is the one true Christianity here, and look where it came. It's like, no, there is no such thing. It's like all those heretics that they were in the second century, they were just as Christian as anything we had. They just didn't make the cut, you know.
And I can kind of see that even in somewhat modern times with like the writings of Nostradamus and how I forgot what his book was called, but it was, they were like quatrains and there are dozens and dozens of them. And
the quintessential example of keep it vague and you can get away with anything because they will reinterpret and reinterpret. Yeah, absolutely. Not to cut you off, but yeah.
Great.
I've got another question here, and it's the person that wrote this. I get it, especially if you haven't read Nailed yet. That's going to answer a lot of this behind it. But this whole concept of nothing new, really. There's nothing new in religion. It's come from something before. So, did the Catholic Church take the attributes of Diana of Ephesus to be their Holy Mother Mary, and were Mithra and Osiris basically Jesus?
Short answer, yes. Long answer, it's more complicated than that. But yeah, not just Diana, but all these saints in the Catholic. Saint Anne, Saint Bridget. Oh, just so happens those are pagan goddesses, but now they're saints, you know. Just coincidence, you know. There always has been a move to take the earth mother, the earth goddess, in all those different forms. Even before there was Christianity, the pagans were doing it. They were starting to say, oh, you know, they're all the same gods. Some were starting to even say, oh, you know, there's really just one God above it all, but these are the incarnations of him. That's a very Hindu way of looking at it. And it definitely was, there were philosophers who were saying that in the ancient world as well. But yeah, pimping out gods to each other and co-opting them and scratching up the serial numbers, that has a long and steady history. I mean,
that's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they did it constantly with rituals, with prayers, with hymns. I mean, and it's so shameless. It's so blatant. And in fact, if you go to Rome, every time you go to one of the really old cathedrals, just go to the basement and boom, there's a Mithraeum there. You know, they always, you scratch a Christian temple and there's a Mayan temple beneath it. Wow. Olaf, I don't mean to keep picking on you, but in Scandinavia, I don't know if you know this, but the specific architecture of Scandinavian Christian churches is because they copied the architecture of Odin and the temples to Odin. Just like in Ireland and the Celtic countries, the Celtic crosses are a sun symbol slapped onto a cross. And
I can see that
before
now.
Before there was the Orthodox and the Catholic, there was also the Celtic Christianity branch. Mm. There's a great book, Irish Jesus, Roman Jesus, that talks about that. But yeah, everywhere the Christians went, they would co-opt something from the local pagans. Christmas, Yule, that's the same thing, right? No, they were never the same thing. My friend Keith Lowell Jensen has a great voice. I love how in the Bible the ancient Israelites would chop down a tree and decorate it with gold and silver astrological symbols and put it in the middle of winter, you know, on the solstice day.
Yeah.
We got time for two more questions. The next question would be, could the non-Trinitarian Christianity triumphed over the current Trinitarian form of Christianity? And by Trinitarian, I assume that means the three-in-one concept, Holy Spirit, Son, and Father.
Yeah. And absolutely it could have, because it's kind of a fluke that we have Trinitarian, because there's no verse in the Bible that says God is three-in-one. All the verses that they even claim say alludes to it don't even allude to it. The concept of Trinitarianism didn't get worked out until Tertullian in the second or third century. And besides, the idea of triple gods and triple goddesses, I mean, that's pure pagan. That's totally Celtic. That's any number of Middle Eastern ancient religions, you know. So yeah, it's kind of a wonder we do have it. it's not a coincidence that Jesus, that God had a son around the same time all these other demigods were becoming rebooted as savior cults, mystery faith savior deities in those cults.
Absolutely fascinating.
So it really is, isn't it?
It is amazing. And I get the sense of how nice it would be to have the luxury of time to delve into it even more, and how challenging it would have been for you to condense all of this into a shorter format, but you did an amazing job. So to bring this all home, how do you recommend we reason with people who actually think their religious texts are true and inspired?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it think, you know? And yeah, at the end of the day, all you can do is, well, I will say this. I used to be a Southern Baptist, and they are the fundy of the fundies. And it was by having a religious discussion with an atheist friend. Actually, I was by flirting with an atheist girl through the guise of theological arguments that it, I'll tell the story because it's a fun little story. So
you told the story in the other video.
Of course I did. I love that story. Well, for you who didn't hear it, basically she said, well, Dave, the Hindu religion is 3,000 years old in Christianity. And as I was getting ready to jump down her throat, I realized, I have no idea if that's true or not. And that realization blew my mind. I was like, I'm just like the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And honestly, from that instant on, I was not a Christian. It's like, it just suddenly, once I asked the question, is this true or not? am I lying to protect something I was taught? And it all just instantly fell apart. There wasn't even like long night of the soul. It's like, it just suddenly felt very weird and very fake, obviously fake from that moment on. Wow. And about a month later, I stopped being a minister at our church, missionary at the church, and I stopped going to church altogether.
So it was a very fast deconversion for you after
super
that.
Fat. One instant.
Yeah, you're kind of lucky in that way, because for me, it was 1,000 cuts. And having this conversation, reading Karen Anderson's Armstrong's book and Irving Finkel's book, those were just small little chips away at that that whole edifice of my old belief system. And so I think that it's not just one thing, but just having this conversation with someone, maybe one of those small chips that might eventually
exactly
contribute to the
class. And you never know what it's going to be for anybody. Everybody's different. In fact, I love hearing people's deconversion stories, because everybody, it's something different was what triggered it, it seems like. And it took a year to get over losing my religion, but my religion was gone instantly. But I freaked out for a year after that. I just could not understand what was keeping me safe.
And I'll be honest, we're here at RFR. We're not here to deconvert folks. We're here simply to be there for folks who are struggling with, like I said at the beginning, doubt and non-belief. But these topics are really important. These kinds of conversations are really important. People struggle with them.
I hear this
all the time in the support groups, and people ask these questions on the helpline all the time.
Well, I'm so glad that all the deists among us were listening to me, and I didn't get any hate mail in the chats that I know of.
You'll get some death threats via email.
but everyone seems to be really lovely, and I always love working with RFR, I'm very happy to be here and can't wait till next time.
David, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate you being here. Before we kind of conclude, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to kind of say?
Just if you are in that twilight zone where you're not comfortable with the religion, but you're not comfortable being without religion, I've been there. I know what that feels like, and I know how weird it is, but it gets better. And the ironic thing is, for me at least, the longer I was not a Christian, the easier it was to be Christ-like and have a Christ-like love for everybody, because suddenly I didn't see people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Terminator going, you're saved, you believe the right thing, you believe the wrong thing, you're going to hell, you're to heaven. All of a sudden, we were all humans, and we lived in the universe, and we came here. This was our home. We belong here. It was an amazing feeling, and it's still an amazing feeling to me. It's like I wouldn't want to go back. I never would go back. I couldn't go back. It's like losing my virginity. It's like you can't undo something like that.
That's very true. So it gets better. You've seen that's it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once-cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the Volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.